the mayor has nominated a highly qualified candidate, and that highly qualified candidate deserves an up or down vote.
Jeff Pastor, one of five city council members who approved Mayor John Cranley's selection of Jim Getz to be the new head of the Cincinnati Park Board. Also on today's show,
it's on us to get energized. It's on us to show up to the polls in November and tell Steve Chabot and the Congress that has enabled Donald Trump, you are fired.
Hamilton County Clerk of Courts Aftab Purival launches his campaign to unseat Congressman Steve Chabot. It's the Weekly News Review, and joining me first are WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge, Inquirer political columnist Jason Williams, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good afternoon to everybody.
Good afternoon.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Jay, let's start by talking about the changes in the park board, the leadership at the park board. What led up to this?
Well, you could probably, one of the TV stations used to do a segment that was called So Cincinnati, and this kind of reminds me of So Cincinnati. Council did something in December. We fought about it for a little bit and came back in January and essentially did the same thing. Mayor John Cranley last week nominated Jim Getz again to be a member of the Cincinnati Park Board, replacing current Park Board President Diane Rosenberg, and council approved that nomination this week.
And that was after Diane Rosenberg had sued, and the judge said, okay, this goes back to council, because they had originally...
It was kind of, everybody was trying to claim victory after that court decision, and I kind of thought of, I saw it more as a split decision. Diane Rosenberg had indeed filed suit, claiming that her term on the Park Board, since she was appointed in 2015, lasted until 2021, and that even if she was to be replaced, the council in December could not impose its will on the new council, which was seated on January the 2nd. And the judge basically ruled that her term ended February the 1st, which was yesterday. But he also found that the mayor could not make the appointment in December. He had to wait until the new council was seated on January 2nd, and that's what they did.
And hence this week's vote, right, Jerry?
Actually, a war over money, not who's sitting on the park board.
Right. What was behind this, Sherry? I mean, what was the reason that Cranley said he wanted to replace Rosenberg?
It all goes really back to the parks levy, and you know the parks need a lot of fixes, millions and millions of dollars, and the mayor pitched a park levy. It did not pass. And it's like, so now what are we going to do? Well, there's a lot of questions. Like, there's money in the foundation. Well, let's see what's in there. And the park board has been very protective of the foundation money. And the city's like, just be transparent about it. What's in there? And not saying we're going to take it, just saying we want to see. But there's a fear that the city might, dip their hands in it to fix the parks. And so the park board's like, nope, we're not going to let anyone see. There's like, a lot of discussions about how that might go, but nothing has happened. So in the interim, the mayor is looking for people who might be a little bit more friendly on the transparency issue.
And those endowments, because that's what I was trying to find out yesterday and today, is how much are in those endowments. And from what I'm told, it's around $20 million. And a lot of people talk about a fund at PNC Bank. Well, that's not necessarily all the endowments that are held at PNC Bank that are controlled by the Park Board. Apparently, these funds are spread out at different financial institutions. The money that ends up in PNC Bank that the parks can use for their projects are basically the interest off of all these $20 million worth of endowments that are elsewhere.
But we're certainly on the side of transparency, so I don't want to suggest that, because we would like to see them too. But when you look at the underlying issues, if we take a peek at like last year's budget, we're facing a very large deficit this year, and they always look for ways to close these deficits. Like last year, they took $2 million that was went to fund public service things like picking up litter and things, and they're like, you know what? That actually is a function of keeping our sewers clean. So we'll take all of that expenditure, relieve the budget a little bit there, and we'll put that in a stormwater fund. Well, our stormwater rates then had to go up for that. So there, like, City Hall is, notorious for shifting around money to make budgets work.
And basically, you could sum up Robert Anning, who I think now is the vice president of the Park Board, wrote a letter to his fellow commissioners. It was either late 2016, early 2017, and there's one sentence. The fight comes down to this sentence. The will's bequest and the endowment language are all very specific and clear and entrust the Board of Park Commissioners with the fiscal authority, management, and control of the funds left to the board for the benefit of the parks. And that's that sentence is what we're fighting about.
The fight comes down to this. So
who can spend the money? And the city says the park board has the authority to spend the money. They just want it to go through city processes concerning contracting and accounting for the money. And the park board says, no, we have the final say on how that money is spent. And as Sherry said, they're worried about if there's $20 million that's laying out there that could be come under the city's control that could be spent for other things, park-related or maybe some not park-related, that's where this is headed. And likely, we assume that there will be an MOU between the park board and the city concerning these endowment funds. And once that happens, then it's probably going to end up in litigation.
Well, those negotiations didn't seem to go well, if you read the deposition
but
that was filed in court.
The makeup of the park board has now shifted.
True.
It was, at that point, 3-2? Now it's 3-2 the other way.
So who is Jim Goetz?
Jim Goetz is... I don't know a whole lot about him. I know he's a member of the city's internal audit committee, and I believe he's a retired auditor from a company here in Cincinnati, and I don't remember the company off the top of my head.
Was he involved in C. Joseph Company?
Like I said, I know he was, like I said, an auditor or CFO for a company here in Cincinnati, and that's how he was selected, I know, to be on the city's internal audit committee.
Was that a guess, Jason, or was that?
No, that's the company he was with. I've never heard of it, but that's what—
So, you know, very fiscally responsible. And you know,
was he involved in the audit of the park board money?
No. Oh, no. Okay. Okay. But, you know, a lot of different audits. And his biggest champion inside City Hall, who really introduced us to Jim Goetz, was Kevin Flynn. Right. And, you know, he didn't run for a re-election, but that is a legacy of him bringing Jim Goetz in and on the premise of we're just really going to be fiscally responsible and watch where the money goes and be transparent about it is how he has been introduced.
And I think now that I think about it, though, I think maybe Jim Goetz did have a role in the MSD's like internal review with
maybe,
Bill Mueller.
And I also feel like he had a part in the Charter Review Committee.
Right. So he's known to a lot of folks inside City Hall.
So the political part of the battle is over, but the fight over this still goes on. Well, maybe not. It's Cincinnati. Maybe not, Jay.
There's always politics. Clearly from Jim Goetz supported John Cranley in the mayor's race. Diane Rosenberg supported Yvette Simpson, and here we are.
You know, so I will say Carrie Blackmore-Smith for The Inquirer, our environmental reporter, has reported extensively on this for years. She pays a lot of attention to this, and she does like to remind us when she's writing about this. This is about every citizen. Don't listen to us and think, oh, politics and like who's on the park board and who gave to John Cranley. She's like, please, the parks need repairs. And she's like, it really boils down to how are these repairs going to get done? Some of them are overrun in Honeysuckle. Every park is not our brand new Smale Park. Every park is not Washington Park. We have these neighborhood parks, and the neighborhood deserve to have their parks fixed up too. And she's like, so really the question boils down to how are we getting that done? Even though we like to write about politics and depositions in court and fights over appointments.
Yeah, ultimately, this is petty politics, really, this fight.
That's what I thought was really refreshing to hear from Tamaya Dennard. Yeah. she basically said, why are we here? I mean, this is not because to Sherry's point, I mean, yes, this does affect people, but the basis of the argument resulted because of politics. And so she was kind of making the argument, do people really care about this? Is this how we should be spending our time at City Hall?
I'll read this quote from new city council member Tamaya Dennard. This issue is exactly what's wrong with City Hall. I was lobbied and solicited on this issue for 20 hours. This affects so few people and taken up so much of our time. Bingo.
So Cincinnati, Jay.
But I would say this is far from over, and we will probably, if Sherry likes to write about depositions and court cases, we will probably be seeing more depositions.
You think
this
will keep her busy?
This will keep us busy.
Amanda, what's the latest on the FC Cincinnati plans to build a stadium? Where is this headed?
Well, it's looking more and more every day, yeah, that it's headed more towards the West End. And that's just what we've been hearing a lot the last week. We've seen a lot of movement there. And given that the MLS decision is pending still, that indicates that that's the site that they might be seriously moving towards. So over the last 2 weeks, which is crazy that it's been 2 weeks, we first heard that the school board was approached by Jeff Birding for a partnership, very vague as to what that meant, but he did mention the West End. And then we found out as well that Jeff Birding had approached the Cincinnati Metropolitan Housing Authority about some land in the West End, too. So that's kind of where we're at now, but still being told that all three sites, Newport, Oakley, and West End, are winning sites from Jeff Birding.
Now, the approach to the Cincinnati School Board, Jeff Birding actually wrote a letter, didn't he, that mentioned
Correct.
Some kind of a potential partnership
right.
with the West End. That's what you're talking about.
Yes, yeah. And it was very clear hearing from the school board members on Tuesday that they really don't know what kind of partnership he's seeking. And the letter was very vague as well as to what exactly does he want out of the school board. And that's left so many people wondering, what are the intentions here? What are the motivations? So we've seen kind of a lot of, I would say, fallout from that vagueness in some sense, because there's a lot of residents that are questioning what the motive is here and how it might impact, in some cases, their backyard, right? Because
right.
we're looking at land that borders residential housing, low-income housing in the West End, or how it might impact schools on the West End, since we have Stargell Stadium, we have Taft High School there. So there's just been a lot of questions going on, and we haven't gotten a lot of clarity either over the last week or so.
Yeah, and I imagine that's year. One of the things that concerns the residents is the lack of transparency in this.
Correct. And I mean, Jeff Birding has tried to release statements being very clear that we don't want to tear down people's houses, that the land that we're interested in from CMHA, we want to use to build more housing. But in some sense, that creates more questions, again, about the motives here, because FC Cincinnati is in the soccer business, not the housing business. So what's their interest in housing? I mean, people can kind of read through the lines here that they're not just going to jump into the housing business all of a sudden.
Yeah, so. Jason, you want to say something?
My thing is I just think the whole process has been not good. It's lacked transparency. It's been just, in Nashville, they rolled it out well in advance. The public had their chance to say they got a site. The city council there, there's like 40 members on their city council there. 31 of them voted for the stadium, and that's why they got the MLS bid before we did. You got to wonder at some point, when is some of the goodwill going to start to kind of wear off of FC Cincinnati? Like, and how far are they going to go on this? MLS, they didn't want Paul Brown Stadium. They didn't want Nippert Stadium. So the taxpayers gave them $51 million for an Oakley Stadium. Now, I mean, do they not want that? Now they're trying to gentrify a neighborhood, and it's like, at what point does this end?
And the other thing, too, is we're talking about someone who has worked in City Hall before. This shouldn't come to us as a surprise to anyone that we're all at this table requesting records, finding out more information. So that's the other thing that I just think is so fascinating about the lack of transparency is there's really no excuse for it on some level, because they should know that we're going to find out about the housing option from CMHA and the school board letter.
So to me, the most interesting thing about the West End has always been in play along with Oakley. Newport seems to be just like the poor third choice. If we have to, we'll do it. But the West End has long, been a real consideration. And, we heard from the community council president that it sounds good. But we learned this week that there are so many different voices. I mean, two entities had public hearings, and these people came forward. And I heard from moms who said, I'm worried about my child walking to school. I mean, there's like little five-year-olds who walk to school by themselves in the West End. This is a neighborhood, and that is an accepted practice in this neighborhood. And they're like, how is this going to impact my child? They don't know. I have, women who are worried that they might not be pushed out of their house, but they're going to, everything else is going to be so expensive and they're going to be gentrified. And, she said about Over the Rhine, which I thought was such an interesting comment. She's like, Over the Rhine is a place where churches aren't churches anymore. They're bars. And I don't want that for my own neighborhood. And she was worried because she doesn't know what's going to happen. And you had agencies like closing the center, well, the Black Agenda with Dwight Tillery and the NAACP. Just tell us. You know, you didn't tell us back in the day when you were tearing down our public housing and you said, oh, yeah, you all come back. Sounds good. And that never happened. Don't do that to us again. Just tell us. And so those are the voices that emerged this week. And they were powerful voices. And they just want to know.
Sherry, do we know where these 60 parcels are that they're talking about? Are they?
They're you know, we had thought that they were looking at land for the stadium itself, but it emerged kind of at the meeting. These are just parcels that are like, it's the unfinished City West. And that would be great to finish that, but I didn't realize that FC Soccer was finishing homes, but that does not seem to be like the truth. But it would fill in City West and really help that part of the neighborhood with homes, if the plan is to be believed. Single family homes at 66 parcels, that could be like 60 homes. And so that would be good for that area, but we still just don't know how that figures in with where the stadium is and what that means.
Yeah, I was going to add, too, it's important to note that they're all empty lots. But again, they're bordering residential housing. You can't just stick a stadium there. What does this mean?
Do we have a sense that MLS is holding up a decision until they can pick a site other than Oakley, than what was in the bid?
Oh, Jeff is not saying. I've never heard, you know, the better couching of words. There's no hints there.
Speaking of that, when might we hear a decision?
We're told before the season starts. Both Jeff apparently has been told that.
That's March or
March 3rd. Okay. Is when the season starts. So it looks like this month could be the month, but we've heard that before from the MLS. So
I will say our soccer reporter, like dedicated to the team, is convinced we are getting a franchise. So all this stadium talk is just, you know, what is our neighborhood going to look like? But if you look at the soccer side, it's a very positive news. MLS is happy. The whole league is happy. We're, you know, there is a feeling out there that we are getting this expansion team, like from a soccer perspective. None of us are soccer experts.
Yeah. I think it does seem positive that they're moving on this land. If they felt like the bid was dead, I don't think they would be causing all this ruckus for no reason. And I think, too, with Sacramento, they really just do not have the financing in line. And that's a bigger hurdle, potentially.
And Detroit's the other contender.
Detroit kind of has always been, it's sort of like the Newport site. It's always been the last option, it seems like, because they presented a football stadium as their, which MLS said that they would prioritize last. But Sacramento just doesn't have the financing in line, it seems. And I think a smaller hurdle is trying to get the stadium nailed down. And I think that's why Cincinnati looks like a better option.
Sherry, you wrote about FC Cincinnati hiring former Cincinnati Mayor Mark Mallory this week. So what's the message here?
You know, nobody loves the West End more than Mark Mallory. You know, he comes from a political dynasty. He comes from just loving that neighborhood and having respect in that neighborhood. And, you know, FC Cincinnati's decision to work with him, I did think that's so serious, right? That they need to get their message out to the West End, because there's no better person to do that than Mark Mallory. And so that was like the third clue, right? Or piece of the puzzle.
Well, we'll say bye to Jay. Thank you for joining us. And goodbye. The three of you will be back in the next
bye,
segment.
Jay.
WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. It's the Weekly News Review. Joining us this afternoon, WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge, Inquirer political columnist Jason Williams, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Hamilton County Clerk of Courts Aftab Purival has entered the race for Ohio's first congressional district, a seat held by Steve Chabot. And Howard, I guess this was one of the worst kept secrets, as Aftab himself said.
Well, yeah, everybody's been waiting for this. You know, it was obvious that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC, had been recruiting him for quite some time. And he went to Washington and talked to him, and they've been trying to get him into the race. Now, that does not mean necessarily that they are targeting this race at this point. What he has to do now is show that he can raise money, which he has, and that he has some grassroots support, which he also has. And then maybe he can get this race moved onto their target list, which they call red to blue, the districts that they really think that they can turn from Republican to Democratic in 2018. But he's not there yet.
Yeah, he's just into the first year of a four-year term as clerk of courts.
Yeah, about 13 months.
13 months. And so I'm wondering why would he do this?
Because he wants to.
Oh, wait. Because also there was nobody else. There was nobody else
people
who wanted to do it.
Yeah. I mean, there were other people. Robert Barr and, you know, Lorianne Weaver and Michelle Young was talking about doing it again. But what the DCCC was looking for was a high-impact person with some charisma, some political skills, and clearly Aftab Perlow has all of that. We found that out in 2016 when he came out of nowhere and won a race against a Winkler, a Republican in Hamilton County, to take over the clerk of court's office. So, you know, yeah, he's only been there for about a year, and now suddenly he's running for higher office. The Republicans, Shabbat's campaign is making a big deal about that. I don't think in the end that's going to matter to voters very much.
I had a Republican source this week that said to me, we have Aftab's number down now. We know the duck. We won't make the same mistake that we made the last time with underestimating him. Do you think that makes a difference in this race?
It's possible. They know more about him, yes. But, you know, this is a different kind of race.
And a
much different year. That's exactly right.
Well, and he has a compelling story, too, behind him.
He has a good backstory. You know, his parents came to this country 40 years ago. The father is Indian. His mother is Tibetan. She escaped from the Chinese communists to get to India. And they ended up settling, of all places, in Beaver Creek, Ohio. And he was born there and raised there. And he's 35 years old. He could run for president, actually.
He'd probably like that.
He would. Yeah, I think he probably would.
And going back to the he doesn't live in the district argument that the Shabbat campaign threw out, there's no requirement that they have to live in their district.
No, there is no requirement in the Constitution that says you have to live in a House district in order to represent it. He has lived in Hyde Park. He suddenly changed to a downtown address, in the morning of his announcement, he changed his address at the Board of Elections. And, the fact is, even at my age, I could probably hit a baseball from Hyde Park into the first district. Okay, it's not that far away. And it's not like he does represent the first district, or at least part of it, as the clerk of courts, because he's clerk of courts for all of Hamilton County. And that includes the western half of Hamilton County, which is in the first district.
So all facts, though, and those are all true things. But when you think about it, and the public perception of this seat is that it's a west side seat, Shabbat's home, and they don't like outsiders.
Yeah.
Look what happened with Judge Ginocchio, right? Like when she was running, like it became an issue in that people like, people who are entrenched and part of their community, and they go to their churches and they go to their festivals. Right. And that's very, it's a community oriented place. That's the perception. It's less about like the facts of where you're actually living.
One of the things that's going to happen is, and this guy has got skill to probably pull it off. Many, many years ago, when Tom Lucan switched from the east side to the west side to run for Congress, he had people convinced over there, and he still, up to his dying day, had people convinced that he went to Elder High School. Okay? He went to Purcell High School. He was an east side guy.
And, which we learned when he was passing. It's where he met his wife.
Right, exactly. And he turned himself into a west side politician. And Aftab Perlow is one of those kind of guys who is going to be so omnipresent in that part of the district that he may be able to convince some folks. The one thing that he has going for him, I think, is that there are a whole lot of – in the Warren County part of the district, which was, you know, the Republicans' gift to Steve Chabot after the last redistricting.
Is that the most heavily GOP part of the first district?
By far, yes. I mean, you know, Hamlin County's turning blue. So, you know, it's that's where the Republicans are. But there are a whole lot more Republicans moving into that district, particularly women who are college educated and are really not particularly fond of Donald Trump. They're Republicans, but they're not really big Donald Trump fans. And the more he can tie Donald Trump to Steve Chabot and vice versa, the better for him.
So here's – I think this is going to be a dogfight. I think it's just going to be a lot of – I mean, it's going to be a lot of fun from our standpoint as journalists to cover. Looking at this district, so the Republicans control 12 of the 16 congressional districts in Ohio. This – of those 12, this is the most diverse. It's 70% white, 30% minorities. AFTAB, this is what the Democrats are really hoping he can bring out the minority vote and really also the women vote, as Howard talked about, because they believe like this is – I keep hearing from the Democrats the year of the woman and, you know, because of – the thought is that they are repulsed by some of the things Trump has said and done in the past, and so you know I won't question that, because if you see you can't help but be like just enamored by AFTAB. He's just a great speaker. He's a great looking guy, and he's just got this you know, personality that you kind of draws you to him. And so if somehow he can, you know, the name ID thing is always an issue when you're going up against someone like Chabot. But if he can somehow, and he's going to raise a lot of money, and if he can somehow get his name out there, I mean, if he gets on your doorstep, you know, he knocks on my door, you think, wow, this guy's, I'm really intrigued by this guy.
But the strategy is to tie Chabot to Trump. Just say he's a rubber
absolutely
stamp.
Sure. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The AFTAB campaign is licking its chops about Monday, hoping that Chabot shows up for Trump's, you know, event here in Censor and Blue Ash.
I'm betting against it, that happening. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah.
So any other thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, Jason's absolutely right. It's going to be a real dogfight. It's an uphill battle for AFTAB. No question about that. Chabot won this district by 18 percentage points the last time. Against a candidate who was not horrible, but she was just didn't have the kind of electricity that the AFTAB brings. I had a veteran Democratic politician in this town tell me yesterday that, and he's been around forever, that AFTAB Purival is the most exciting figure he's seen in the Democratic Party since Jerry Springer started. And when Jerry started, he was like a rock star when he first started running for city council. And he said, I haven't seen this kind of excitement about a politician since then.
How much can he campaign and then still do his job as clerk?
As much as he wants. I'm telling you. I mean, look, you know.
It's not that hard to be clerk.
It's an elected official job. They don't have to clock hours.
That's why they hire staff, you know. And he wouldn't be the first county official or you know, state official to go around and spend more time campaigning than he does in his official office. You hire people to run those offices. You're an elected official. You're responsible, but you don't have to be there every minute of every day. He's not sitting there stamping court documents as they come in.
But that's something we've already seen the Republicans try to attack him on. And AFTAB just seems to rub that party the wrong way. I mean, and I think because
he's a threat. They don't see him. Yeah.
I mean, this guy, you know, I love the story that he told after his clerk of courts campaign. You know, he beat a big name there, as Howard mentioned. And, you know, I think over a 15-month period campaigning, he said he put 30,000 miles on his Jeep Grand Cherokee. So he is going to raise a lot of money, and he is going to be out there. He is a very hardworking, aggressive campaigner. So I tell you, I didn't think he was going to win last time. I will not underestimate him this time. You can't doubt him. You cannot count him out and think, oh, that's a Republican-drawn district, so he's not going to win. Yeah,
I would never bet against this guy.
Yeah, me neither.
He has too many skills. He has the charisma. He has the ability. He has the stamina to go through this.
There's no event that I go to that he's not there.
Yeah, right.
How many events are you going to if you're at all of the ones that I go to?
And Sherry, he's all over the place, all over the state, too. I mean, he's been acting as a surrogate for Sherrod Brown in various parts of the state. So he's getting a statewide reputation, and he's going to get money from all over the state. He was the president of the student body at Ohio State University, which people really don't understand is like a political launching pad.
Yep.
You make a lot of connections, and it helps you raise a whole lot of money somewhere down the line when you decide you're going to make a career in politics.
Howard, has there been talk of him running for a statewide office before he ran for
federal
office?
Oh, there's been talk of him running for everything.
For everything?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, and there will be, you know. But, you know, he had to make a decision. And his decision was that this was the race. And the DCCC talked him basically, you know, into doing this. And he decided this was the race that he wanted. This is a race that he thought he could win.
Hey, this guy's going places. I think you're going to see the Republican machine do everything it possibly can to try to take him down. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily just for this race, but hoping to take him out for the future because he is a tremendous threat.
Is there definitely going to be a primary, Jason, or do we know yet?
It's starting to fade away.
Yeah.
It's fading away very quickly.
Well, Amanda, Sharon, and Jason, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks.
WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge, Inquirer political columnist Jason Williams, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. Coming up, an update on the Ohio governor's race and other news from around the state. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The Ohio governor's race is going to end up being expensive, and here to talk about how the candidates are doing when it comes to fundraising, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Good afternoon, Joe.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Campaign finance reports came out this week. So I want to talk about how those shaped up. It's follow the money time, but who has money on hand? Who's shaping up the best in this?
Well, that answer depends on who you talk to. Everyone's spending it differently. Of course, the Republican candidates have quite a bit of money because you've got to remember when Husted and DeWine went together, all that money that Husted had is now available to their combined campaign. So that showed up in these campaign finance reports. We saw that. But we did see Rich Cordray in the very short amount of time that he was in there. He was able to raise a substantial amount. And in some of the down ticket races, it looks like the Democratic candidates actually did very well in the fundraising. So, but by and large, the Republicans still, they lead in fundraising by a large margin.
Yeah, and Richard Cordray, it's an interesting point because he just joined the race in early December?
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. It was just right at the very end of November.
Right, and this reporting period went up through December 31st.
Right.
So, you know, and he raised over $2 million very quickly, very quickly. And he's not done yet. So, you know, he's going to raise a substantial amount of money. I think, if, in fact, Mike DeWine is the Republican nominee for governor, and if, in fact, Rich Cordray is the Democratic nominee for governor, Cordray is going to get outspent. But he is going to have plenty of resources, and he's going to have plenty of help, too, from the outside, from outside of Ohio, that's going to come in here, you know, people like Elizabeth Warren, maybe even Barack Obama, for whom he worked for some time.
So let's see, Mike DeWine and John Husted, they had what, about 10.5 million on hand, mm-hmm. Joe?
I don't have all the numbers right in front of me, but that sounds
about
right.
As you pointed out, a lot of that came after Husted shut down his campaign.
I believe there was about 4 million, wasn't there, Howard, from the Husted campaign?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
How expensive are these statewide races, governor's race in particular, Joe? How expensive do these things get? I mean, how much does it cost?
You know, that's a really good question. They just keep going up. So I think, you know, every year it's more expensive than it was last year, it seems. I don't know why, but it just, you got to understand there's all that outside spending, too, that goes into it. And that's often where the bulk of the spending comes, is from those outside groups.
Yes, the Republican Governors Association, the Democratic Governors Association, all kinds of third-party independent expenditure groups who might favor one candidate or the other are going to, you know, finance attack ads on the other guy. And it starts to – the money raised by the candidates themselves almost is dwarfed by the amount of outside money that's being spent on these races, whether it's the governor's race or the U.S. Senate race. The same thing's going to happen there.
513-419-7100 to join us, and David joins us right now. Hi, David.
Hi, good afternoon. Just wanted to give an update with the Ohio Green Party. The Green Party doesn't take any corporate funding. It's all grassroots funding, and where the other parties spend millions of dollars per vote, we spend about 63 cents per vote. And right at this moment, the Hamilton County Green Party is on the way up to Columbus to meet with the rest of the Ohio Green Party to file for the governor's race, Constance Goodell Newton.
Do you have a gubernatorial? Who's your gubernatorial candidate?
Yeah, that's Constance Goodell Newton. They're filing this afternoon at 3 o'clock, and the vice governor will be Brett Joseph.
And the lieutenant governor?
Brett Joseph.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right.
Thank you,
that's
David.
Lieutenant governor.
Thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thoughts on the Green Party? I mean,
well,
honestly, I've been trying to chase that down all day today. I haven't received press releases. I'm still trying to chase it down. The Green Party, generally, any of the secondary parties, the Green Party, the Libertarian, they are always way behind in fundraising. But that's okay because for them, in their eyes, because what they want to do is focus on more of the grassroots kind of stuff and focus on getting out there and playing that role. So,
and to a certain extent, they raise issues that the major party candidates don't generally talk about, and they try to get those issues out on the table. Sometimes mm-hmm. they're more successful than others, but you know, they have a very steep hill to climb in order to, you know, become a real factor.
Any idea, either one of you have any idea how many votes they usually get in a race like this, percentage wise, or?
I'd have
not
to
enough to be a real be designated as a real party.
I mean, it's
party.
In single digits, mm-hmm. you know, generally speaking.
There were a couple of candidates in this reporting period, Dennis Kucinich and Bill O'Neill,
right?
Who I don't think they showed up any fundraising during the 6 month period. Why is that, Joe?
Well, you've got to remember that Bill O'Neill just stepped down from the bench at the end of January. And so, you know, he really couldn't, you know, under the way it was, constructed, he couldn't go out and do that. As far as Dennis Kucinich, he got into the race in January. So both of those people came in late.
They came in late.
Came in after mm-hmm. the deadline of December.
Right.
December 31st was a cutoff on these reports.
Are there more reports yet to come? Will they do another round of these, Howard?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay. When's that?
3 months from now?
Yeah, about 3 months from now, I'd say. Yeah, that's right.
Joe, what's the latest on the efforts to redraw Ohio's congressional map? And that would be the federal districts that they're redrawing, right?
Right. These are the congressional districts that they're trying to redraw. And, of course, there are, the legislators up here in Columbus have come up with a plan that they would like to pass through both chambers and then put on the ballot in May. And that plan, the GOP members are behind it, but they really need Democratic support. And they also want to get out there and get the support of the Citizens Coalition, a bunch of citizens group, Common Cause, League of Women Voters, the Environmental Council, some others that are going together and pushing, they're collecting signatures to put a different kind of issue, redistricting, but a different way on the ballot in November. So these lawmakers, the ones that are pushing this legislative plan right now, they would not only like to get Democrats on board, they'd like to get those citizens groups to agree to the legislative plan and then say, hey, we're not going to go in November, so that they could all get around this one plan. The problem is that the talks have broken down. Right now, the citizens groups say some new language has been sent over to them, but that's about as far as that's gotten. There was a possible as-needed session that's been scheduled for Monday in the Senate, but we've seen these as-needed sessions come and go, and they've been basically dropped this week because they haven't been able to reach agreement. And if they don't get this passed through the House and the Senate, by Wednesday is the deadline to get the 7th of February, I believe that's Wednesday, is the deadline to get their issue on the May ballot. So they've got to do something fast. And right now, it doesn't appear like anyone's close to an agreement.
This always seems to be a very difficult issue every time it comes up.
Well, it's going to be it's near impossible to get those two sides together, as long as the legislature sticks with the idea of that in the end it's a partisan majority decision on districts, and the citizens groups just are never going to accept that.
Right. Right. And, the citizens groups actually have kind of the upper hand a little bit in this when you think about it, because they don't have anything really to lose. If they go in November, they've got two-thirds. They say they have two-thirds of the signatures they need. If they go in November, they're facing an electorate that really is kind of fed up of politicians, if you see every poll out there. This should be a pretty easy sell in their minds. But the lawmakers are the ones who really, and the GOP lawmakers in particular, are the ones who really would like to get everyone to get behind something now and be big, happy family and be on the same page.
Am I understanding this correctly, Joe, that you've got two different plans? You got the one the lawmakers are trying to come up with and put on the ballot for May. Is that right? And then the citizens group has its own plan that they'd like to put forward.
Right.
Okay.
A very different plan.
Right.
Than what the legislature is proposing. And I think Joe's exactly right. It would probably benefit the citizens groups to just say, okay, you guys, there's no point in talking to you anymore. We're going to put our issue on the ballot in November, and we'll see what the people of Ohio say.
Right.
Joe, you wrote about State Representative Bill Seitz. Apparently, four of his female colleagues are saying that he should resign. What's this over?
Well, there was a roast last week, and ironically, it was the day after they did the sexual harassment training. And this roast was for an outgoing GOP staffer who had been with them for a long time. It was not here at the State House. It was about a block away. This roast, there were a lot of GOP members there because it was a GOP staffer. And so anyway, there were some comments that were made. They were denigrating to women. They made fun of a current Republican lawmaker and a former Republican lawmaker. People took offense, especially women took offense. And then later on this past week, some apologies were issued. Senator Seitz did apologize. And Senator Matt Huffman was also called into this because he had made a comment that didn't sit well with people either. And so after all these apologies were basically, you know, sent out, there are still lawmakers who are not happy, particularly female lawmakers. And yesterday, four Democratic women who are in the General Assembly, they are calling for Senator Seitz to lose his job. They want him to lose his leadership position and lose his job because they say that this is so egregious and that the Speaker of the House should put his foot down and make sure that this is taken seriously. You know, they point to the fact that there was just sexual harassment training, and the very next night, all these comments come out.
Well, and the Speaker has basically just said, well, I gave him a good talking to.
Right.
So he really hasn't faced any discipline, just got a good talking
right.
to.
Okay. Yeah.
But there's a history of this.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we've had several situations over the past few months. We had Senator Cliff Height, who resigned over sexual harassment. We had a representative who there were some questions about his behavior and had done some things. He had to resign. We've had other issues that have been I don't want to go through the long list of things that have happened, but there are many other issues that have been happening. And then this week, right after sexual harassment training, this happens. So, you know, the point is being made by some lawmakers that, hey, this isn't sinking in and you've got to do more than just, you know, offer apologies.
Yeah. And it seems that there has to be a realization that this is 2018. It's not 1965.
Right.
In you know, Columbus, because I mean, you know, this kind of thing in the past, in the old days, was commonplace, and nobody ever said anything about it. But now people do, and now people will stand up and say, "No, this is not acceptable."
Howard, President Trump's coming to town next week.
Yes,
Jason had mentioned it earlier. And what are the details? What have you found out?
Well, don't know all the details yet, but he's going to Schaeffer Corporation up in Blue Ash, which makes industrial parts, and they last month, Senator Rob Portman went there, and he said that Schaeffer had given its employees a $1,000 bonus because of the new tax plan that was passed by Congress and signed into law by President Trump. And now the president wants to come here and make it this an example of what the new tax plan can mean for working families in America. Because it, actually, if you look at the polling, it's not very popular. And he's trying to turn those numbers around.
Now, this will be, what, his second trip to Cincinnati?
Since he became president, mm-hmm. Yes.
And is anybody going to be attending that, any of the candidates? Or?
Well, the only ones, no, I mean, Mary Taylor, who's running for governor against Mike DeWine, is supposed to be coming. And Rob Portman's press secretary says that he's going to be there. That's about all I know of at this point. Mm-hmm.
Joe and Howard, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles and WVXU Politics reporter Howard Wilkinson.